My guest tonight is an author, and he is a teacher. He's one of the foremost exponents of the power of myth to direct and shape an individual's life, and perhaps the direction of a culture as well, and history itself, as a matter of fact. He's a specialist in comparative mythology. His work encompasses many diverse subjects, including Tantra, the pre-Christian mysteries, Gnosticism, shamanism, which we'll be discussing at length tonight, alchemy, astrology. He's a naked eye astronomer of great skill. And his name is John Lash. He's a remarkable man. He's a gentleman that I had the great fortune of meeting and spending time with last October. As you may remember, those of you who have been listening to the program for that length of time, you'll know that I was in Massachusetts and spent time with John and Joanna, of course, who you're familiar with. But he's someone that we've been looking forward to having on the program with great anticipation, and live tonight from his home in Belgium. Ladies and gentlemen, John Lash, welcome to Radio Orbit. John, wonderful to have you, finally.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's a great fortune to be here with you. I'm very pleased to have met you in October, and that way I can kind of, I know what you look like, so I can kind of visualize you there in front of me.
Yeah, me
and,
too.
But it's very good to be on the line with you.
Yeah, me too, John. It's a pleasure and a long time coming, and there have been a lot of people that have been looking forward to this for a long time, so I'm glad we have a chance to do it. So, all right, well, look, I'm going to make the use of my time. I just spent the last half hour trying to get you on the phone, believe it or not, and so we're gonna make it worthwhile tonight. I've been talking to the listeners a little bit as we've been getting going tonight about you and your background and the fact that there are many different topics that we could probably talk about. We narrowed it down a little bit off the air. But before we get into the topic of the evening, primarily shamanism, for my listeners, John, who aren't real familiar with you, why don't you give them just a quick background, a little bit of framework, so they know who you are, where you've come from, and give them a good reason why they should hearken this evening.
Well, sure, I'll give it a try. I don't usually talk about myself, but I'll see what I can come up with. The basics are that I was born in New York City, and because of personal circumstances in my mother's life, I grew up in a small town in Maine called Friendship, a small lobster fishing village. And that was a great shift in my destiny, the fact that I was born in a large city, but at the age of 4, found myself in this idyllic fishing village, because my connection with nature actually began at that point. And my life would have obviously been very different if my mother had remained in the city. So I grew up in, I've traveled around the world. I've been to, I think, about 30, 35 countries, seen a fair amount of the world, and Friendship, Maine is one of the most beautiful places that I've ever seen.
Amazing.
So I had the opportunity to grow up in natural, unspoiled natural beauty. And that has a lot to do with who I am and how I found my path in life. The other parts of my biography that might be helpful, I can just think of three things very quickly. One is that I began to have mystical or paranormal experiences at an early age, and I am a great believer in spontaneous enlightenment and in the experience of mystical states or satori or whatever you would want to call it, as coming to someone without practice, coming to someone just naturally, because that happened to me, and I don't think I'm the only one that's ever happened to in that manner. So throughout my life, from a very early stage, I was not so much seeking to go on a spiritual quest whereby I would enter a path and do practices to achieve something. Rather, I went on a spiritual quest in the attempt to understand what was happening to me and why I had these extraordinary encounters and these moments of mystical illumination and so forth. So that really determined the trajectory of my life from dreams I had, lucid dreams, at about the age of 4, really.
Wow.
And then following that, I had a hard time in school. I had a hard time adopting to system, although I was an honor student and that sort of thing, and I loved to learn. I dropped out of college because I couldn't play the game. Hmm. So in the early 60s, I dropped out, and I'm basically self-educated. I don't have a degree in comparative mythology, even though that's my field. And then it just went on from there. I would say that experiences of my life led me to question beliefs and to question particularly the beliefs that I had been taught or told. I don't think you can say we are really taught beliefs. We're just told what to believe.
Right.
And since we're told at an early age, even if we as children think that what we're told to believe is nonsense, it's very difficult to resist it. It's very difficult for the child to stand up and challenge what they are told to believe. But I've always had that tendency for some reason, and that led me pretty much to where I am now. The books I've written have all been about questioning beliefs and looking into the supernatural and paranormal aspects of human experience. Excuse me. And my interest in mythology, lifelong interest, and in the mythology of the stars and the sky, for instance, has been driven by the fact that I believe that there is information in the world at large, in the cosmos at large. I think it was Huxley who coined the term mind at large.
Hmm.
And I would say that the whole course of my life, from those days in Friendship, Maine, where I had the opportunity to walk on the beautiful coast of Maine and swim in those waters and row out to those islands and be in contact with nature, The drift of my life from that moment has been to understand the mind of nature and to consider or imagine how we might have a way of life that is not based on belief and unsupported principles and dogmas, but based on a living contact with the mind of nature.
Mm.
And that pretty much, as you know, Mike, that pretty much sums up what I'm working on these days in MetaHistory.org and in the other writing that I'm doing.
Right. And let's do that, John. Let's give out the website real quickly one more time. Everyone, if you're interested in information about John and the work that he's doing, jump on the web and go over to MetaHistory.org, MetaHistory.org. It's a fascinating website, and it's like a good book, actually. MetaHistory is a place
where you
can... Yeah, a
1,500-page book.
Yeah.
So take your time.
and the reason I use that reference is because you can sort of click anywhere, and wherever you end up, you can sort of just jump in there and find something cool. And a good book, I've always thought, is one that you can just sort of open up and put your finger down in the middle of the page and start reading at that point and be somehow engrossed. And that's the way MetaHistory is. It's very deep, and there's a tremendous amount of information there. And I appreciate the work that you guys have done there. So,
well, thank you, Mike.
All right, so there are lots we could talk about. Your resume spans a collection of many different disciplines. We decided tonight to talk a little bit about shamanism. It's one of my favorite topics, and one that I don't think, John, can be really overestimated in the terms of its relevance to the cultural dilemmas that we seem to be facing currently, not just as Americans, and of course you're in Europe, and I'd be interested in some of your perspectives from that particular vantage point as well, but as a species in general, it's something that has struck me for many years now, something that is very, very important. So I think where we should get started, maybe you could give us a little bit of a background on shamanism as a definition, what you think it means actually to begin with.
Well, sure, I'd like to do that. I'd also like to suggest to the listeners that apart from the material on shamanism on MetaHistory, there's a wonderful book by Ralph Metzner, which I'm sure you know very well, called Tiananmen, the Sacred Mushroom Visions. And that book has an introduction in it. It has several essays, and it has a very long introduction called Visionary Mushrooms of the Americas.
Mm.
and I'm looking at it right now. It's a beautiful book, and it's 48 pages long, this introduction. The book is published by Park Street Press, so I guess that would be Inner Traditions. Anyway, that 48 or 45 page essay by Ralph Metzner covers the modern revival of shamanism. And since I place myself in that movement and consider that I belong to that, that would probably be a good place to start. I strongly suggest that book and especially that article to anyone who wants to get an overview of what has happened since the 1940s, since just before the Second World War, in terms of the contemporary face of shamanism. Now, we all know, of course, that shamanism is a very ancient, you know, path. I used to have a joke. I always used to try to joke when I was talking about spiritual things back in Santa Fe years ago when I was teaching. And sometimes my jokes went over pretty well, and sometimes they didn't. But this is back in like the mid-70s, and at that time, actually, shamanism was just becoming into vogue.
Right, right.
And at one point, I was having a conversation with someone, and we were talking about various spiritual matters, you know, in the New Age, under the New Age umbrella. And they said to me, you know, well, gee, what about shamanism? You know, Michael Harner has written this book, and it looks like this is something that might be worth looking at. And I shook my head and I said, it's just a flash. It'll never last.
It's only lasted for, what, 2 million years or something?
It's only lasted for the whole history of our species, really, you know.
Right.
And yet the fact is that it has become a tendency, it has become part of a kind of revival since the late 40s. So I would suggest that we should take a dyadic view and always have in our minds a concept of what shamanism is in the ancient sense, in its most ancient, timeless sense.
Okay.
And then look at it, what it is in a contemporary sense.
All right,
that's how I view it.
Good.
So in its ancient sense, in timeless sense, shamanism is the practice of exploring worlds that are outside the cultural model of society. It's something that every society, every human culture, in order to be a culture, must define itself on human terms. And so it must be self-referential, because the culture is a organization of individuals who are together to survive together and to serve their own needs and to create a human world. But that human world is always set in a non-human world. And in its ancient sense, the shaman was the intermediary between human culture and the human-made world and everything that lay beyond it.
Mm.
And basically what lies beyond the human-made world can be viewed in two ways. First of all, it's just the setting of nature and the habitat and the ecosphere in which other species live, other than human species. That's part of it. And the second part of it is it includes the non-human environment of any culture or community includes the supernatural dimension, the Nahual. The unknown, the realm of dreams, the realm of departed spirits, the realm of demons and angels. And so that is the setting. Nature and supernature, you might say, Mike, perhaps, are the setting for any human culture. And the genius of the ancient shamanic practice is that the shamans knew that no culture and no community can exist in that setting and be isolated from that setting and merely ignore it. Therefore, there have to be always members of a community who are intermediaries. You know, not everyone in your community can be or should be a shaman.
Hmm.
This is not the way it was in the ancient model.
Right.
And I think that as far as the ancient model goes, that still holds up pretty well. But for a community or culture to to be sane and to survive, there must be members of that culture who go outside of it into nature, into contact with other species, and into the supernatural, supernatural dimension, and bring back their experiences to the community. That is the primordial model of shamanic, of the shamanic role. And I think it's also, as far as I know, and I think there are many people who would agree with me, historians, prehistorians, and anthropologists, as far as I know, that is a very stable and reliable model for human community and culture. Whereas the model that we have been following for some thousands of years now is based on a cutting off of the human community from those two other dimensions. And we have become too human, in a sense. We have become too human-centered. We have lost the interspecies connection, and we have lost our sense of the supernatural. And that is why we have a sick society today. And I believe that the shamanic way still is, as it always was, a great remedy to our sickness.
All right, well, so this is the past, and it goes back, we joked about it a little bit earlier, but it does go back a tremendously long time, right?
Well, no one can say how long it goes back, you know. The shamans of South America, there's this wonderful book called The Three Halves of, I can't remember what it's called, Three Halves of Italo Cavo, or something like that. It's a book. No, The Three Halves of Ino Moksho. It's a wonderful book on shamanism in which one of the South American shamans from the great wetlands of the Amazon says it's a joke that shamans were walking on the earth 20 million years ago.
Right, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is a topic that sort of comes up, and I'll digress for a moment, but over the last few weeks I've had it come up a few times. The idea of deep time, you know, it just seems that, or at least to certain people and to some of my listeners, they're very tentative in believing or buying full well the ideas of dating and things like this. And, you know, the idea that we really know exactly when all of these things happened in the last 5 billion years, when, you know, when our data sample is so small, I guess.
Certainly, and the methods of dating are really highly questionable. I mean, you have to you have to accept that they're merely a convention, and that they have very little intrinsic truth in them. We really don't know. The best way to know what happened to our species is not to go scrabbling for evidence, which isn't there, or construct fantasy systems which allow us to pretend that we know what happened in prehistory. The best way to know what happened to our species is to tap the species memory. And I think it's becoming understood now, at least I'm trying to develop this point and make this point. That was also one of the experiences of shamanism, particularly ethnogenic shamanism. Shamans who went to the plant teachers and learned from the plant teachers, as, say, for instance, ayahuasqueros today, were shown by the plant teachers how to access the racial and the genetic memory of the species. And that's the best way, that's the most reliable way to know how we evolved. And, you know, I read science and anthropology and prehistory, like, you know, other people do, but I certainly read it with a huge grain of salt.
Yeah, there was actually an article, I was actually trying to find it just now, but just a couple of weeks ago, an article came out talking about the cave paintings in Europe, not far from where you are, as a matter of fact.
Right, right.
And it was a stunning article, actually, to me, because they actually had in print that a consensus had developed And that consensus was among paleontologists that at some point, in some, you know, sometime within the last, I don't know, 35, 40, 50,000 years, that this outburst of creativity that was represented by some of the amazing works of art that are done on the walls and the ceilings of these amazing cathedral-like caves, in Europe, that they were the product probably of shamans, under the influence of some sort of a botanical psychedelic. And of course, this is something that, you know, our good friend Terence wrote about many years ago, and he didn't get any credit for it in the article, and it was shameful, I thought. But the idea that this is becoming a mainstream idea was, I thought, pretty important and really cool, as a matter of fact.
Well, that will certainly help, Mike. I think that will certainly help people to come into more respect and understanding of shamanism, because mainly because those sites do exist and they are of spectacular nature. So that catches people's attention.
Mm.
And if people are told that it might have been the case, as you say, that they are somehow connected with entheogenic shamanism, trance states, and so forth, it's a good way for people to get onto the subject of shamanism, certainly.
All right. Well, we're talking about shamanism in a context right now that you mentioned, and I'm talking about the psychedelics, I guess. Metzner wrote about the mushroom. We're talking now about the shamans who did cave painting and ritualistic ceremonies in the caves in Europe that was directly related to these sort of things. We certainly know that in South America there's a lot of evidence for the sacred mushroom religions down there historically.
And there is in Europe as well.
And in Europe, you know? And I think this is one thing that Metzner points out that's so important, that there is a European tradition of this as well. But let me ask you about the Western history. I mean, this stuff has been around for millions of years, but in the West, it seems like it just sort of got on the plate of Western science maybe 100 years ago with, you know, the Germans isolating mescaline. But then I don't think until the 1950s, when Gordon Wasson brings psilocybin back to the West, that anything really gets interesting. And very soon after that, all of this stuff was made illegal. So it seems like there was very little time for Western science to even assess with a reasonable lens what was happening with these things.
Sure. Well, I think there's a more or less, of course, we're talking about a very complex historical problem. How did it come about that the use of sacred plants and the practice of entheogenic shamanism has been made illegal, has been condemned by culture, and put under a very serious taboo? It's a huge question. But I think it would be helpful to point out one thing, perhaps. I'd like to talk sometime in the course of the morning about what I see as the three generations of the current shamanic revival. And the first generation was actually European, and it began with Robert Graves and Maria Gimbutas. Robert Graves, of course, who was a British poet, who was who wrote The White Goddess, who was very interested in the mysteries of antiquity, and lived, although he was British, he lived in Palma de Mallorca, which is an island in the Mediterranean, belongs to Spain, and took psychedelic mushrooms and rediscovered the traces of mushroom cults in Greece, Portugal, and Spain. And it was actually a letter from Robert Graves to Gordon Wasson that cued him to go on his quest. Wasson had actually two cues. One of them came from, this happened in the 1940s, just before and during Second World War.
Okay.
He had a cue from Robert Graves, and he also got a cue from Maria Gimbutas, who was the Lithuanian archaeologist who has done, as you know, this wonderful work on rediscovering the goddess cultures in old Europe, as she called it, which is the Balkans.
Does that include, like, the historical references to Minoan Crete and places like this?
Yeah, she didn't particularly treat Crete. and Minowa. That was more something that other people picked up. But she was, Gimbutas was the one who established by archaeological evidence that before civilization rose, according to this usual scenario, civilization rose in, arose in the Middle East around 4,000 or 4,500 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
She established that before civilization arose in the Middle East, there were in old Europe, which is the Balkans, and in Turkey, highly advanced civilized societies, not huge urban societies, but small-scale human communities that were quite complex and sophisticated, and they were all goddess-oriented.
Mm.
And having come from Lithuania, where there's a considerable mushroom culture, closely related to the mushroom culture of Russia, remember that Wasson's wife was Russian.
Russian, yeah.
Yeah. She also gave Wasson a clue leading him to the into the Soma, toward the Soma.
Mm.
And so the initial clues that launched the revival of shamanism today came from two Europeans, and they were picked up by an American, R. Gordon Wasson.
Right, right.
Now, getting back to your question, Mike, I think the problem is that the taboo against the use of these plants, these sacred plants, because we're not talking about drugs or chemicals here, we're talking about plants that are found in nature, Syrian rue, the psilocybe mushroom, in various species, the amanita, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The taboo on those was established in the Middle East and spread into Europe, and it's essentially a part of Christianity and a part of the Judaic Christian tradition. As you know, the story of Adam and Eve and the tree in paradise has been interpreted as an entheogenic story.
Sure.
And the forbidding of Jehovah's forbidding Adam and Eve to eat of the tree represents the taboo placed by Judeo-Christian religion on entheogens.
Yeah, that's a wonderful metaphor, and it's really interesting when you think about it, because at the root of that story in Genesis, it's really denial of access to a plant.
That's right.
I mean, that's what and, that, that's what the story
and
is.
And it's denial of access to the knowledge that comes through that plant. It's denial of access to the plant species that are able to teach us about being human and able to teach us about the cosmos. And so the Judeo-Christian religion begins with that taboo. And consequently, I think it's fair to say that Judeo-Christian religion, and following it, Islamic religion, which is of the same development, really, is based on the denial of our connection to the divine intelligence of nature. So it's not surprising that those religions have led us to a very, genocidal and suicidal brink where we stand today. To get back and complete my response to your question, the taboo was established originally through this Judeo-Christian monotheism. I'm not the only, that story isn't original to me, you know that, I'm sure. And then it spread into Europe, and so the taboo was established in the minds of Europeans for many centuries before they came to the New World. So we must understand that when the Europeans started to come to the New World, in Columbus's time, and even more later, say in the 18th and 19th century, when they poured across the United States, they were people who had already had that taboo enforced in their culture and in their minds for many, many, many generations.
Mm.
And so it was a foregone conclusion to them that there could be nothing, it could not be allowed. It could not be allowed to exist. And so to the extent that the settlers encountered that, those practices, for instance, we know a lot about them encountering those practices in central Mexico.
Right.
Which is where Wasson went to retrieve it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But insofar as they encountered them, they not only had the religious, demand to destroy, indigenous wisdom, but they also had they acted out the taboo that had been enforced on them. And the result of that was a wholesale denial and repression of the entheogenic and shamanic way of life.
But it seems like it was maybe a little bit of a too big of a cookie to bite into, because, you know, the Western style is sort of to completely assimilate and subjugate other cultures, literally swallow them up, you know, and then turn them into another extension of Western scientism. But to me, it seems like the psychedelics were too big a bite to swallow, and they literally became taboo maybe for that reason, because they really are dangerous. In other words, they were, not only were they made illegal to, you know, you and me or whomever back in the late 1960s, but they were also taken off the menu of scientific research, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy. I mean, back in the Middle Ages, you know, the medical students used to chase around armies and go to the executioner's gallows at night, you know, to try to find dead bodies and stuff that they could examine, because the church had made it illegal to examine dead bodies. So the students would go out and, you know, find them in the field or whatever, just so they could try to learn physiology or something. And now it seems like that sort of scientific enthusiasm has been replaced by, I'm not sure what, government grants and corporate budgets or something. But it seems frustrating, though, because, I don't know, it just seems like it never got a fair shake.
Well, I would have two observations about that, Mike. One is that, in the first place, and this is just my personal opinion, I don't believe that, as you know, I draw a very strong distinction between drugs and psychoactive plants.
I agree, yeah.
And I also cite Terrence, who said that the psychedelic message is an anti-drug message, and that's a very important soundbite. I do not endorse the use of any drugs of any kind, chemical drugs or laboratory-made drugs. Schultes and Watson and others have taught us over the last 30 years that of the many uncountable plant species on the earth, there is a tiny sliver which have psychomimetic properties. About 200 species, is what Schultes says in Plants of the Gods. There are about 200 species that we know of today scientifically that create, when they're ingested, that act on the chemistry that already exists in the human brain, on the neurotransmitting chemistry. And those are the sacred plant teachers, which were recognized in many cultures around the world for thousands and thousands of years. Now, to reflect on what you were just saying, I personally don't consider those psychoactive plants to be dangerous. Of course, one can take them wrongly. One could poison oneself if one did not make the correct ayahuasca formula, or if one did not prepare it correctly. And there are psychopharmaceutical things that one needs to know. But in terms of their effects, I do not consider them to be at all dangerous. They have never been forbidden because they are dangerous. That's the lie of the paternal patriarchal control system. They've been forbidden because they give us ecstasy and wisdom. And the controllers in society do not want the members of their society to have ecstasy and wisdom. It's the last thing they want them to have. So that's why they've been tabooed. And on the other hand, you're absolutely right. It's impossible to repress something of that nature. So what do you have as a consequence? Well, Terrence has written about this extensively. You have a society of addiction.
All right. Well, let's talk. So that goes back to the statement that you made that I think really is profound, that the psychedelic message is an anti-drug message. Maybe
absolutely.
Why don't you expand on that a little bit?
Well, if you look at our society, I don't think I would be, you know, raising anybody's eyebrows if I said that our Western society, let's just talk about America and Western and Europe, the Euro-American culture, is a culture of addiction. We are not only massively addicted to laboratory chemicals and drugs, our food is loaded with these chemicals. We are addicted to tobacco in a very evil form, not the kind of tobacco that the American Indians smoke in their peace pipes, but a polluted form of tobacco with over 120 additives in it, which are known to be cancer-causing. We are addicted to alcohol, which is an extremely dangerous drug. We are addicted to pills of all kinds. We're addicted to bad food. And I won't even go into the other aspects of addiction. For instance, you know, technological addiction, the internet, and, you know, atrocious forms of entertainment. Let's just leave all that aside. Let's just talk about our addiction to substances. And Terence made the observation in his Food of the Gods, that Plants of the Gods or whatever, sugar and coffee and the way that we are addicted to these things is a reflection of, is the negative reflection of what has been taken away from us. That craving for ecstasy and wisdom is so innate to us, to our species, that if you take it away, as you say, it's a big bite to remove. It's a big need to deny. If you deny that need in a society, the consequence will be to drive that society into addiction. So, to me, drugs, I hate the word drug, drugs belong to the addiction and to the problem, but psychoactive and entheogenic plants belong to the healing and the solution, and they should never be confused.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's such an important distinction. I mean, one of the major obstacles we have is the problem of language. I mean, just the fact that we use this one word, drugs, to somehow embody all of these different substances, things that do everything from make your toe tickle to make you see God, you know, and they put one word and try to wrap it around all of these different things. Then they use the same word in somehow a completely different fashion for all the pharmaceuticals that are somehow legal.
Exactly, and I think it's very intentional on the part of some people. I think that using that word in an extremely misleading way is part of the taboo and part of the disinformation campaign against shamanism.
All right, John, look, let's take a break and come back and talk a little bit more about this stuff. I've got a few more questions for you. We've got some more time here, so let's do that. We'll take a break, listen to a little bit of music, and we will come back with my guest. His name is John Lash. And information about John can be found at www.metahistory.org. You can also go to my website at mikehagan.com and jump right over there as well. Okay, this is Martin Lind. We've been listening to him throughout the night. We'll continue to. This song is called Night Owl. Back in just a minute. This is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. And John Lash in just a few more minutes.
That's Martin Lind, Basic. And that song is called Phase One. I take it back. That's called Night Owl. Pardon me, this is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit. My guest tonight is John Lash. We're talking to John live from his home in Belgium. Lucky to have him in the morning time on Tuesday for him, and just approaching 15 minutes until 1 o'clock in the morning here in the middle of Missouri. So, all right, John, thanks for sticking around.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's a great privilege to be here, and also a great opportunity to talk about this particular subject, because I do believe that when we talk about shamanism in a sober and even-minded way, we are really talking about the deep look and the deep view of the human psyche, of human evolution, and of the whole religious dimension of human experience. It's a tremendously important subject. But having said that, and before we proceed, I wonder if I could just make one statement. I do have a reservation as well, which I'd like to make clear to our listeners. I don't want to, in stressing the importance of this subject, I don't want to come across as if I'm some fanatic who's insisting that everyone take entheogenic substances. I certainly am not. I certainly don't even believe that. In fact, it's not for everyone to do. In fact, one of the interesting questions that we face in terms of the contemporary revival of shamanism is, who would be the shamans in a community? Suppose, for instance, that you and I and a group of friends formed a community somewhere in Costa Rica. You know, we decided we were going to go create an eco village. We don't want to be part of the system when it comes down. And so we create a community of 150 people in some wonderful conditions, you know, in Costa Rica.
Right.
And one of the essential questions within that community, within that eco culture, would be who does the practice with the entheogenic plants? Because as a matter of fact, it's not something that is easy to do, and it is something that must be done with great discretion, and the inclination to do it is not always present, even to people who have done it a lot. What I'm trying to say is there are intrinsic cautionary measures in this experience, which need to be recognized. But the most important thing is that a sane society, a sane culture, will consist of some people who do the entheogenic practices, a great many people who don't. But the people who don't will understand and communicate with the people who do. That's the key.
That's
the key. But I'm not coming off, please don't anyone interpret me as coming off and saying, you must do this and everyone must become a shaman, because I don't believe that.
Yeah, I think it's good that you make that clarification. And we've talked about, you know, we talk about this relatively frequently on the program, and I try to make it the same point, that this is not recreation. It's something that requires understanding long before the voyage, you know. And I remember one thing that Terrence said a long time ago in an email to me. He said the first trip in the psychedelic voyage is to the library. You know?
Yeah, he had a way of putting it very well.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Inform yourself, you know, find out what's happening. Look at the pharmacology. Look at dose response. Look at, you know, how these things react with the neurology of the brain. And then, you know, you can go in with a little bit of a different set. And, of course, we all know now that this is the big thing. You know, how you go into the experience is as important as the substance that helps you get there.
Yes, your mindset. There must be preparation. As you know, I distinguish very rigorously between recreational and sacramental use.
Mm.
And while I don't want to come off like a bigot and condemn anybody, personally for me, I do not do recreational use of psychedelics, and I do not support it.
I agree.
But sacramental use is what we're talking about here. And that is ritualistic. The shamans in every society were not, you know, ignorant pig farmers who happened to eat mushrooms that grew out of dung. They were educated. They were bards, scholars, poets, storytellers, historians, healers, physicians, astronomers, astrologers, And so there's a great body of, and a great discipline that goes along with his practice.
All right, John, a little bit before the break, we were talking about European ancestry that followed these traditions. I spoke to a guy last week who, and it was just after St. Patrick's Day, and we did a program on what he entitled The Irish Origins of Civilization, and he went into great depth about the Celtic origins of some of these things, and we talked about...
Is that Peter Lamborn Wilson?
No, his name is Michael Therrien.
Uh-huh.
And he's very interesting, and...
Because there's a book by Peter Lamborn Wilson called Irish Soma.
Really?
Yeah, and it's a book about the use of, I suppose, Amanita muscaria among the ancient Celtic and Irish cultures, and particularly in connection with the Bardic cultures.
Well, this is exactly what we were talking about last week, and we really didn't get deeply into the shamanic side of it, but certainly... That was a component of it, and he, you know, a lot of people don't like to talk about these things, John. And you know, you get too close, and then it becomes, well, you know, we just don't go there. But certainly in the Druidic line, there is evidence of the mushroom again.
Oh, certainly, and you know, I spent a great deal of time exploring sacred sites in the British Isles. In Scotland, Ireland, England, and Wales.
Wow, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's a great concentration of sacred sites in that part of the world because to the Celtic peoples who lived there and the other indigenous peoples of Wales, who the non-Celtic and the Celtic, but as you know, the Celtic was kind of the unifying culture.
Mm.
The West, the direction of the West, was the direction of the afterworld, where people go in the afterlife, and it was also the direction, symbolic direction, to go on the shamanic quest. And so most of the great stone circles and megalithic monuments are located in the west part of Scotland, the west coast of Ireland, Wales, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I've visited, you know, dozens and dozens of these places and spent time there. And at the same, those places in themselves will change your consciousness. Just being there in them, if you allow yourself to be fully present, or if you meditate, if you want to use that word, or surrender control of your mind and allow yourself to float and to access what's there, those stone circles, by their very construction, by the ambience of them, will change your consciousness and carry you into shamanic states.
Hmm.
But in addition to that, mushrooms grow all over the place in all those parts of the British Isles.
Hmm.
They grow in profusion in Wales in September and October.
Hmm.
So there's no question that they were there and that they formed part of the practices. But you know, of course, you know, I don't think any fossils of mushrooms have been found, you know. So evidence, that kind of evidence doesn't exist.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you eat it. You eat the evidence.
Right. And then do create an alchemical transmutation on it, you know.
That's right. But Graves, just to add, Graves totally connected the Bardic tradition of the Celts with the use of psilocybin mushrooms.
Okay. Well, yeah. I think it's important because... You mentioned Ralph Metzner earlier, and he
mm-hmm.
he also wrote, and in fact, I didn't even read the book that you mentioned earlier, but I read Well of Remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a piece that you actually sent to me a couple days ago that remarks about that book, but he makes it clear that it's important that for us as Americans, I think, in the West here, most of us do have European roots.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tendency to flock to South America or to Mexico and go do ayahuasca with a whole bunch of gringos around a fire with a shaman of questionable intention or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to recognize that there is a root in many of our own traditions. It's just a matter of recognizing it and going and looking for it.
It certainly is important, and at the end of the day, you just have to conclude that the the practice of entheogenic shamanism was planetary, you know? And you can find it in Siberia, Polynesia, Wales, Portugal, Spain, Greece, Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, there it is, you know. It was a bioregional phenomenon.
Well, all right. So this is its background. Where are we now in 2006?
Good question.
I mean, 36 years, 40 years after, 50 years after Gordon Wasson brings it back. I don't know.
Right. It was 1957, actually, that the Life magazine article appeared, bizarrely enough.
Isn't that amazing?
He went there, I think, in 54, but it was 1957 that the cover article of Life magazine was about magic mushrooms.
Right, and shamanism. Yeah.
So that will be next year, that'll be 50 years.
That's when I gotta go on eBay and see if I can find.
I'm sure that magazine sells for a lot these days.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right, so here we are, 2006. It's been 50 years, and we still haven't come to terms. But what do you see happening today?
Well, I consider today that we're in the, you know, to use a technological term, we're in the 3G, the third generation of psychedelic and psychonautic technology. The first generation having been Graves, Huxley, and Wasson himself, and of course Albert Hofmann,
right,
1947, discovery of LSD. That was the first generation of psychonauts who brought back and reconnected us to this shamanic path. Then Wasson, of course, belongs to that generation, but also bridges into what I would call the second generation, and that would be Wasson, Schultes, Leary, Michael Harner, people like that. We're talking about the developments that sprang from Huxley's books on mescaline and psilocybin and Wasson's retrieval of the mushroom cult. So then we would go, the second generation goes up until about the early 80s. You know, Wasson himself died in 86. And in 81, I think it was, or in the early 80s, he and Carl Ruck and another, and Jonathan Ott wrote The Road to Eleusis, which is kind of the consummate statement of the second generation of psychonauts. And that, the thesis of that book, in case your listeners aren't familiar with it, is that the potion that was drunk by the initiates at the Mysteries of Eleusis was an entheogenic potion using the fungus of ergot. So essentially it was a liquid form of LSD.
Right.
And that thesis, called the Wasson thesis, there are two aspects of the Wasson thesis. One is his thesis that soma can be identified with the Amanita muscaria mushroom. And the other aspect of the Wasson thesis is that the kikion, or the sacred drink of Eleusis, was an entheogenic brew. So those were tremendous developments that came out of the second generation. Now we're in the third generation. And by the way, Ralph Metzner is the one person today who spans all of these generations.
Right. And Albert Hoffman's still alive too.
And Albert Hoffman is still alive as well. But Metzner to me is really the outstanding figure, because he was there, you know, when this thing kicked off, and he's still here, and he's still as sober and lucid and warm and wonderful as ever.
Amazing.
And stands as a living monument to this development. But specific to the third generation, I would say, would be people like Mike Hagen and Terence McKenna, Jonathan Ott, who was born in 1947, and Dale Pendel, who's written this wonderful trilogy of books on psychopharmacognosis. And I would put myself and Joanna Harcourt Smith in there, although we're old enough to be, you know, considered as part of the second generation as well.
Right.
And the whole question is now, I think, Mike, what does the third generation have to say? What is our unique contribution to the revival of shamanism? Mm-hmm. That's one question.
Right.
And the second question would be, as we were talking just a minute ago offline, where can we see this practice emerging in the world today? What is the appropriate way and the safe and sane way for this practice to be redeveloped?
Right. Well, it seems to me a little like a growing up of sorts. In other words, in the 60s, it seemed like the people that were experiencing LSD and some of the other psychedelics thought that they were discovering something for the first time. They really had little knowledge of the historical facts of shamanism.
That's right.
You know, now we have 30 years of thanks to people like you and many of the other people that you mentioned, we have 35 years now of research and background that now legitimizes this many of these ideas and really puts them on firm ground. And I think that's a significant difference between
that's
now and
that's tremendously important. You're absolutely right, Mike. The ethnographic and anthropological background we now have is tremendous, and that was developed by the second generation. Terence himself, as you know, acknowledged that with deep gratitude. Terence said that he was very fortunate to belong to the phase of the psychedelic movement that was not just, as you say, taking psychedelics in this kind of naive way and thinking we discovered something that was never known before, but having an understanding of shamanism and anthropology to go with it. So that's where we are, and the question is, in this third, where is the third generation going to go, and where is it? How is it going to set up? What comes next?
All right, John. Well, look, let's come back. It's the top of the hour. I need to take a short break here, but we'll come back and do that. We'll talk about where we want to go next, and maybe you can give some insight into how we maybe get to some of these places. Okay.
Great.
All right. Sounds good. My guest is John Lash. Information about John can be found on the web at www.metahistory.org. And MetaHistory, by the way, is a production or a presentation that is sponsored by the Marian Institute. And information about the Marian Institute can also be found on the web at www.marianinstitute.org. All right, this is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few moments. One more time. Our musical guest tonight, this is Basic. The song is called Phase One, Independent International Music on Radio Orbit. Back in just a few minutes.
Furthermore, we have not even to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. We have only to follow the thread of the hero path, and where we had thought to find an abomination, we shall find a god, and where we had thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves, and where we had thought to travel outward, we shall come to the center of our own existence, and where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world. John, that's a quote from one of my favorite mythologists. His name is Joseph Campbell. I'm sure you're...
Sure, Hero with a Thousand Faces, yeah.
And I wanted to read that because I know that mythology is a big part of this, and there's a connection between shamanism and mythology and the past and the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that maybe we could try to bridge that a little bit and talk about that as we discuss shamanism and its potential to help us into a new future or a future at all. And maybe you could discuss a little bit about mythology and the connection there.
Sure, I'd love to. It's very appropriate, Mike. I have, of course, studied Campbell's work on the hero. He's very well known for his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, but I also wrote a book on the hero, which is this little book published by Thames and Hudson in London called The Hero, Manhood and Power. And I take a rather different view from Campbell. That is, I don't exactly adopt his model. The point that I make in my book is that to understand the hero, we must have a view of masculinity, change our view of masculinity, and understand that throughout history there have been men who have aligned themselves to the goddess and to the feminine powers in the universe and have been in service and adoration of the feminine. And there have been men who have developed their power against the feminine. And to me, the true hero is the man who develops his power and realizes his manhood in service to the goddess and not in the attempt, as patriarchy has done, to overcome and defeat the goddess, which is a theme that many myths seem to suggest, man against the female monster type of thing. So it's an important background to understanding the shamanic quest because, in a sense, of course, the male shaman is a hero figure. But, of course, that's only part of the picture because shamans have also been females all through history and continue to be today. And Barbara Tedlock, as you know, has just written a wonderful book on the feminine, the role of women in shamanism.
Yes, yes.
I think one of the great opportunities that shamanism offers us today is that it does offer this gender balance and that both men and women are equal in this quest.
Yeah. Very interesting. You know, this idea of men as shaman is another one that sort of is a co-opted idea.
It is.
Yeah, because Barbara has written a wonderful book. It's called The Woman in the Shaman's Body. And she even makes a point to talk about Iliad, Mercer Iliad, who, although his work was certainly very valuable and important, she points out some of his own bias, wherein cases he actually eliminated, segments of the feminine role in shamanism in some of his own research.
Oh, absolutely. There are some things to really watch out for in Eliade. I've drawn deeply from Eliade. In fact, I'm much more the heir of Eliade than I am of Campbell.
Mm.
But at the same time, I would warn that particularly in regard to shamanism and in his classic book, which for many years was the main reference, Archaic Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, buyer beware.
Right.
There are some things in there that are just not right at all.
Well, and that's the way it goes.
Of course. We all make mistakes. I'm sure I've made my share.
Right.
And that's how we learn through our own mistakes and through detecting the mistakes of other people.
Absolutely. Well said.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, the future of shamanism and the present. I mean, what do you see in Europe right now as regards to the zeitgeist? I mean, what's the sense of these sorts of things over there right now?
Well, in terms of the predominant culture, that would be to say the ordinary culture, popular culture, there's absolutely zilch.
Mm.
And certainly Europeans are far, far behind America in that respect.
Is that right?
Yeah, Europeans have not woken up to many, many things. They are people who tend to be very opinionated and very nested in their idées reçues. In the ideas that they've received and in the scripts that have been passed down to them. They tend to be very conservative, very passive, intimidated by authoritarian figures. So in the general panorama of European culture, European life, European intellectual life and so forth, there is almost no awareness whatsoever of the importance of the things we're talking about. So you have to really ask the question, well, is there a counterculture in Europe in which these things are known and in which these things are emerging? Because in the mass culture there's nothing.
Okay. All right, we haven't talked too much actually about why shamanism is so important. In other words, we touched a little bit early on about nature and this idea of the connection to nature. And I know that this is one of the primary roles of shamanism, is to be that bridge, the link between, as you mentioned earlier, the natural world and the worlds that are outside of that that arena. So let's talk a little bit more about that, about why is shamanism a better idea than Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Well, you raise a very important question, Mike, and I think that we need to be extremely conscientious, those of us who, rather take the role of discussing these things publicly, and somebody has to, kind of not set an agenda, but bring the subject into definition. It's a big responsibility, and one must talk as clearly as possible, and one must be able also to make very subtle and crucial distinctions. For instance, I would say, first of all, that we're talking here, you and I right now, about entheogenic shamanism. Now, there may be other forms of shamanism, and in fact there are, which do not use entheogens. That is to say, dance, trance, drumming, nature vigils, nature quests, going out into the wilderness and spending time with maybe fasting and having a vision quest, but not necessarily taking psychoactive plants. And again, I want to make it clear that I don't have a totalitarian mentality about this. I'm not insisting that entheogenic shamanism is the best and only way. It just happens to be what we're talking about here now.
Right.
So as far as shamanic practices, and in fact, in terms of Europe, there are workshops and there are groups all around Europe, in Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, who do kind of vision quests and Michael Harner type of shamanic workshops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that does exist, and I don't discount that in the least. But your question focuses on the subject that you and I both share a deep interest in, and that is, what is the role and what is the value of the shamanic experience with sacred plants? So I think this is important today for a very simple reason, and I can put it in one word: Gaia.
Hmm.
What we have today in the third generation is we have the Gaia hypothesis and a growing understanding, not just in the counterculture, but in popular culture to some extent, that the Earth is a living entity, a living, intelligent, self-organizing entity. And I would say that the great step that we can make, or perhaps it would be better to say, we stand on a threshold now in the third generation of the shamanic revival. We stand on a threshold where the practices with sacred plants could be taken in the direction of Gaia communication, in the direction of a deepening of our contact and understanding of the living planet, and possibly even direct communication with the intelligence of the planet.
Right. Well, something like that is at work. For anyone who has, you know, actually had this experience and done it in the right manner, in the right context, at the right dosage, in the right set and setting, anybody that's had this experience knows that there is something going on like this. I mean, there is a communication, an intelligence that is outside of you. I mean, there's no other way to explain it, at least not to me.
And but there's a paradox here as well, Mike, and I'm sure you're aware of this. Those people who have had this experience, or who have spoken to friends who have it, and who have a sympathetic and trusting attitude toward those friends, and, you know, are willing to listen to their experiences, all know that when you ingest a psychoactive plant, you give part of your consciousness away to the species, to that other species. It's an act of interspecies communication,
yeah,
really.
Yes.
And there's an exchange that takes place. Terence often discussed this. For the pleasure of joyriding in our nervous system, which is what these entities do, they like to be in our mind. Mm. And for the pleasure of being in our mind, they give us part of their mind.
Mm.
And part of their mind brings our attention away from human affairs, away from ourselves, our own personal identity, away from culture, and toward the world of nature and the living intelligence of nature. So it catches your attention. Your attention is brought to that. But there's a paradox here, Mike, because I'm sure you would agree that even though it's easy to say that entheogenic practice will lead us to Gaia, in fact, there's very little reference to that in any of the literature.
Very true.
It's odd, don't you think?
It's really strange, and it's one of those things that, I'll have to quote T again, but it's a secret that keeps itself.
Yeah, you could say that.
Something like that. I mean, I have this. I also have this sort of intuition. You mentioned that it's an interspecies communication. It's a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's right.
And part of it to me, and again, this is, I'm just speaking from my own experience, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not speaking for anybody else. There seems to be a choice that's involved. In other words, you make a choice to eat the mushroom, for example. There also seems to be, as silly as it sounds, a choice on the part of the mushroom to involve itself in the relationship in some way, shape, or form, because it can be unpleasant. I mean, if you're an egomaniac control freak and go into one of those deep experiences, it will take you by the short and curly and just throw you against the wall, you know?
Well, that's their job. They're guardians. They're guardians, and no one is going to go into the deeper intimacy of those circuits. Leary called them the rapture circuits.
Mm.
Rapture circuits. No one is going to be, no human being, and this is just the way it's set up by nature itself, Mike, no human being is allowed to go into those sacred realms and bring their ego and their expectations and their projections and their personal shit with them. And so that's why if you take psilocybin mushrooms and you have not previously prepared yourself for ego death and surrender, they're going to give you a very hard time.
Mm.
Because you will not be allowed to come in carrying that ego baggage.
Right.
Yeah. So it is, you know, it is a two-way exchange, and the sacred plant teachers act not only as teachers, but as guardians of what they're teaching.
Amazing. You know,
yes, it is. It's fantastic.
It is amazing.
And, you know, I personally think that Gaia herself created these entities, produced these 200 rare psychomimetic species out of all the millions of gorgeous and fantastic plants as a special gift to us to help us with the affliction of being human. and to help us get over being human. You know, David Abrams has a wonderful saying in his book, The Spell of the Sensuous. We are only human in contact with and communion with all that is non-human. And these plant teachers allow us to make that communion happen. And as far as I'm concerned, that's, if we are going to move now, knowing the planet is in crisis on an environmental level, if we're going to move toward a more sane way of life, I do feel that these plant teachers could help us very much to guide us in that direction.
All right, and that is that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak.
That is it. That's right. Yeah.
All right, well, let's see. Let's talk a little bit more about women, then, and the role of the feminine in this whole thing.
Oh, great. I'd love to. Well, you know, the biggest woman in my life is called Gaia.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say that that's just a metaphor, and some people object to, you know, the goddess revival of this language and calling her a goddess. But I can only say that I'm a poet and I'm a mystic, and in my experience, the intelligence and the physicality of the earth is feminine.
Hmm.
And I'm not the first one to say that, you know. Races and cultures from time immemorial have said the same thing. Why do they say that? You know, I don't know of any single culture, any single myth that claims that the earth is male. And there's a reason for that. So not only do we contact the divine feminine through the earth, but women, the females of our species, have a very, very key role in preserving and maintaining that connection.
Mm.
It's total disinformation you find in Eliade that, you know, men have been the dominant players in shamanism. It's just not true.
Right.
And it's a very unhappy piece of it's a very unhappy mistake.
What do you make of the prehistorical evidence of partnership community type situations like may have existed on Minoan Crete and places like that? Do you think that that's a legitimate historical situation? Let me clarify really quickly, John. What I'm thinking is that that idea, this idea that at some point in the past there was a partnership community or a situation where men were in balance with women and all in balance with nature, that sounds a whole lot like the nostalgia for paradise that we all see, you know, represented in all of these religions. And I guess it just seems to me that maybe there was a time like that. Maybe we really were, you know, thrown out of the garden by Yahweh as Narc, sort of, you know, as you mentioned earlier, and we've been suffering from that ever since, and we're just trying to get back to the garden.
Well, I think it's kind of a trick question, Mike. I think that there is a risk, and I would, I'm wary of this myself. There is a risk of make-believe. There is a risk of wishful thinking.
Mm.
And wanting to pretend that it was once that way. And, of course, we need to be cognizant of that. But when all is said and done, I would say, I would say this. It comes down to each individual. If you, man or woman, are able to find in yourself that gender balance and the tenderness on which it depends, and if you are able to find in yourself and in your own life a kind of harmonious triangulation between man, woman, and nature, then you have proven the proposition is true.
Hmm.
Whether or not it actually was realized in these cultures in the past, no one can ultimately say. But each of us can prove that the proposition is true in ourselves.
Right.
And that's what really matters.
Right. Fantastic. All right, metahistory.org. Let's talk a little bit about your website and some of the things that go on there.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be able to say something about it because this website has been a tremendous gift to me from the Marian Institute and from the Baldwin brothers, Michael, Ian, and Philip, whom I work with, my collaborators and sponsors. And it's been a tremendous experience writing for this website over the last 4 to 5 years. I want to make it clear that MetaHistory.org, however, is not a website that broadcasts or that was specifically created to broadcast or promote entheogenic shamanism. Mm. As you know, Mike, there are a great many psychedelic sites on the web. Many of them, and many of them have forums, and there's an enormous amount of discussion going on about all kinds of psychedelics, mixing them with drugs, mixing them with sacred plants. For instance, there's a site on the web called deoxy.org, which is a fantastically sophisticated psychedelic site which deals with shamanism, entheogens, and it's really a brilliant site. The problem is, in my experience, that deoxy.org and all the other sites in that category seem to be created by and populated by people who are doing recreational use of psychedelics.
Yeah, I've noticed that myself.
Yeah, they are genuine psychonauts, and some of them are genuinely trying to explore the psyche and the labyrinth of the mind and cosmos. But in general, I don't find that though they are Gaia, pointing in the direction of Gaia-oriented shamanism, and nor do I find that they have the emphasis on sacramental use rather than recreational use. So when I started writing MetaHistory.org, I didn't have the intention in my mind that it would be a channel for this message, but it evolved into that naturally over a number of years, and I really like the way it developed, because before I was able to actually come out and discuss the issues that we're discussing here in this conversation on the site, I built a very extensive foundation for that discussion. I think it's very important to frame the discussion that we're having in a certain way, to frame it carefully and to establish a sane and sober mindset. And that's what I was able to do, because in its inception, MetaHistory.org, as you'll see if you tune into the homepage, has two stated purposes. One is to question beliefs and belief systems and try to go beyond the tyranny of beliefs, especially religious and ideological beliefs. And the second purpose of the site is to propose a future mythology which would guide us toward a relationship with Gaia and a coevolutionary status with the planet. So those are the two stated aims, and I spent about 3 years developing the site in that manner before I began to introduce the option. And let's remember that that's always what it is. It's
right.
Just an option
right.
of entheogenic practice.
All right. Yeah, and as you mentioned, I think it's important, the whole idea of the spiritual side or the sacred side of these plants, these compounds, it's not implied. In other words, you mentioned earlier that there are a number of different ways that a shaman or a shamanic practice might be used in order to get into a trance state, drumming or dancing or
right.
or ordeal or whatever. But assuming that we are talking about the ingestion of a plant, it may be necessary, but it's not sufficient. In other words, you definitely have to take the plant in order to get there in your apartment or whatever. But if you don't have the right, again, if you don't have the right intention and understanding and all these sort of things, it will not be, as you say, maybe a profound connection with the Gaian mind that we're trying to establish.
It won't be. I'll guarantee it. And I'll tell you that these characters, these species, are smarter than we are.
Mm. So
they're smarter than we are, and you better pay attention to that. And one of the requirements, as you well know, for serious a sacramental practice is ego death.
Oh man.
Yeah. You have to let go of who you are, who you think you are, your pretenses, and all your personal ego baggage. and go into a condition of surrender in order to be able to be taken to these experiences of deeper insight. I mean, that is just absolutely essential. Mm. And that's part of the setting requirement.
Okay. All right. One of the things that you talk about at great length, and I'm very interested in it as well, on the site at metahistory.org, and let's give out that web address one more time, www.metahistory.org. John, one of the things you write about is Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Gnosticism and the connection between Gnosticism and maybe a shamanistic revival of sorts, because there's certainly a shamanic tradition in the background of Gnosticism as well.
There is indeed. The thing that I would say about Gnosticism is that it is an unfortunate word, and it has been an unfortunate word since the beginning of its usage, which is initially found in Plato, because it has a lot of disinformation and negativity attached to it. For instance, one of the first things that you encounter when you read into Gnosticism or pick up a book on it is that scholars have developed a model of what the Gnostic worldview was. And according to that model, they say that Gnostics were people who viewed the world, the material and physical world, as a delusion or a prison created by an evil spirit, and that Gnostics proposed that the human beings are divine sparks captured in this darkness, and the purpose of the spiritual path is for us to free ourselves from the prison of materiality and sensual delusion. That model I completely reject. That model is not an accurate model of what the Gnostics said or taught. It is a model that's derived from the Christian war against Gnostics.
Wow.
It is a model and a label that was placed on Gnostics in order to condemn them.
Wow, and, I'm sorry, I got to jump in, but that's amazing that you said that, and I'm so glad you did, because there have been a number of different people that I've read over the years that I could only describe as dark Gnostics. I mean, they are just as dark as they come.
Mm-hmm.
And although there was information there that rung true to me, and I was like, well, yeah, I understand this, and it makes sense, but I was always like, no, I never bought the whole idea of the demiurge and all of this sort of stuff, and that we were just a mistake or the accidental humans and that sort of thing. I'm sorry to jump in, but I'm really excited.
No, you have good instincts
that,
there, so. And I don't think you're alone in that. I suspect that there may be other people who read into Gnosticism and who have this model thrust upon them, this erroneous and misleading model, and maybe are shaking their heads and saying, well, this doesn't sound quite right to me, you know. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to sort out that disinformation and get through it. But I have attempted in the MetaHistory site to propose another model. And in my model, I would substitute the word Gnostic. For the word Gnostic, I would substitute the word Illuminist. The path of Gnosis was a path of Illuminism, psychosomatic Illuminism. Gnosticism was a sophisticated form, a sophisticated outgrowth of European shamanism, going back to the Stone Age. This is, by the way, what Kenneth Rexroth says in his preface to Fragments of a Faith Forgotten. It's a book on Gnosticism by G.R.S. Mead.
Wow, what a fantastic title.
Yeah, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten. It's a great title. To sum up a very difficult and complex subject in a sentence, my fix on Gnosticism is that Gnostics were seers who used psychoactive plants and also used Kundalini yoga, techniques of Kundalini yoga, to develop a highly sophisticated worldview based on their direct perception of Gaia. They had a central figure in their mythology, a goddess. The central figure of the Gnostic worldview is a goddess, as you know, called Sophia. And I've argued all through the site, you can see this, there's a word search function on the site. If you put in Sophia, all this material will come up, or if you go to the Gaia Sophia Navigator, it will take you to all the places on the site where I discuss this. I am arguing that the specific focus of the Gnostic and mystery tradition in Europe was entheogenic practices focused on Gaia, focused on the goddess Gaia or the goddess Sophia. And so that represents for us a model that we can take today in our understanding of Gaia and possibly the model for the future development of shamanism.
Wow. All right, well, look, it is about 23 before the hour. Let's take a quick break here. I've got to take one more, and then we'll come back, and we'll have a few more minutes.
We'll do a final segment. We have about 15 minutes, right?
Yeah, we got about 15 minutes, okay?
Excellent, Mike.
All right, John, hang on just a second.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. All right, everybody, this is John Lash, and we're lucky to have him. He's live with us from his home in Belgium, and information and tremendous amount of material that John has researched and developed over a number of years can be found at www.metahistory.org. And we'll be back with John in just a second here. One last song by our friend Martin Lind. This song is called Rain. We'll be back in just a few minutes with John Lash. This is Mike Hagen. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Rain from Martin Lind, and we're going to cut it a little bit short here and get right back to our guest, John Lash. All right, John, we're back to you.
Good to be here.
All right, yeah, we got about 15 or 20 minutes left, so a little bit of time to talk a little bit more about some of these things. Hey, I wanted to ask you quickly, I know you were at the Albert Hofmann Conference. What was that, two months ago or something like that?
Yeah, 16th of January.
Yeah, maybe you can give us a little overview of what your thoughts were about what went down there. That was in Basel, I think, in Switzerland, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, it was a tremendous experience. There were 1,500 people at the conference. And it was three solid days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to the end of the day. Albert Hofmann spoke at the beginning of the conference and at the end, and it was his 100th birthday. It opened on his 100th birthday.
Amazing.
On a full moon.
Amazing.
And on a Friday the 13th, I mean, it was pretty spectacular. It was tremendously moving experience for a number of reasons. One, because Hofmann was there, and he spoke in such a beautiful, humble, and childlike way about his discovery of LSD, with such enormous respect for that entity and how it called him and how it brought him back to his love of nature as a child. I mean, it was deeply moving. I wept like a kid, and many people did, hearing him speak. I also felt throughout the whole conference, Mike, I can't tell you the impact that went over me like a wave. It was like a tsunami of grief.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A tsunami of grief for my generation and what we have been through, and for the great opportunity that I've had. I was born in 1945. The great opportunity that I've had. I was 15 years old in 1960. And to have been part of this 60s revolution and of the psychedelic revolution, which is only just a name we put on the reemergence of something in the human spirit. In the 60s, something reemerged in the human spirit through this shamanic retrieval that we've been talking about.
Right.
And we had a fantastic opportunity to change society, to change ourselves, to reconnect with humanity. And all of that was blown away and destroyed. And there are, you know, it survives now in certain individuals, but it does not survive as a social movement of any kind. LSD was made illegal. I'm not a pro-LSD person particularly. I'm not against it either. Perhaps I should say that to me, LSD is kind of like trainer wheels on a bicycle. If you want to have a test run of a entheogenic experience, then take some LSD. But if you want to go on the trip itself, LSD is not going to take you there, you know. But it was tremendously important that it opened the window of opportunity. And then I relived with many of the people at the conference, because many of them were of my generation, relived the grief of what happened to that window of opportunity and how it was shut down and how the 60s went bad, really bad, really fast.
Jim,
how many people were lost along the way. So it was a tremendously moving experience. I was shattered at the end of this experience. Joanna as well.
Yeah.
We both were. We laid around for a couple of days. We could barely move. I mean, it was emotionally very, very powerful. On the other hand, in terms of the content and treatment of the conference itself, I had two objections. One, it was very white male intellectual. Most of the lectures and the talks were almost professorial clinical talks.
Really?
Yeah, about LSD and chemistry.
Right.
There were some women. There were about three or four women presenters, and there were about 40 or 50 men presenters. So there was a lack of the female element. There was too much white male intellectualism. And getting back to an observation that you just made before the break, there was a lack of the sense of the sacred. And that was the most unfortunate thing. I didn't feel that at the conference. There was a lot of reverence for Albert Hofmann. And there was definitely a kind of reverence, an attitude of reverence toward LSD. And in that sense, you might say there was a sense of the sacred, but not sufficient to me. It was lacking.
Yeah, amazing. Well,
powerful experience.
It sounds like it. And I have to wonder, you know, this thing that happened in the 60s that you talk about that went bad, as you put it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where are the people, you know, where are the other John Lashes? I mean, there had to be many other people, as you say. I mean, there was a whole generation of people that had, to varying degrees, these experiences, and they're now in, you know, middle age and in corporate America or in positions of power or whatever. Have they just lost those experiences and no longer incorporate them into their worldview? Or I mean, it seems like for me as a person who's had the experience, I can't let it go. I can't just walk away from that.
No. Well, this is something, of course, that Joanna and I talk about a lot. Joanna Horcourt Spiff being my best friend of 20 years and my partner on the MetaHistory site and a great psychonaut in her own right. You've had Joanna, of course, on your show. We talk about this a lot and ponder it a lot. And we ask ourselves, well, can we be the only ones? Well, of course, we're not so arrogant as to imagine that we are the only ones. We know we're not. We just suffer because we know that there must be survivors of that phenomena, of that vast cultural upheaval, who still are holding the essential truth of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And those people need now to connect with each other for the benefit of future generations. The problem, Mike, is not that the true survivors of that moment aren't here. The problem is that they don't know each other. They're not connected. They're scattered.
Mm.
They're scattered. But I'm sure there are some. And of course, the one that is known is, of course, Ralph Metzner.
Right.
Ralph Metzner is the holder of the continuity of the whole process, as far as I'm concerned. He embodies the continuity, and he embodies someone who was there at the beginning, he was there in the middle, and he's there now.
Wow.
So Metzner is a wonderful sign of hope for us and a wonderful symbol that the movement and the moment of truth continues. But I would be so happy if somehow those people who are scattered around the planet would somehow get in touch with each other. And maybe that's what we'll be able to do through the wonderful site you're now doing with Joanna on our Future Primitive project.
Yes, and we should mention that really fast. And I've talked about it on the program before, but we're very close to releasing the first program, Future Primitive. It can be found on the web at www.futureprimitive.org, and that's a cooperative effort between myself and Joanna and John Lash at MetaHistory and the wonderful.
It's the twin site to MetaHistory.
Yeah.
And whereas MetaHistory is very text heavy, I'm the main author and it's mostly written, Future Primitive is going to be a vocal, and it's dedicated to oral traditions.
That's right.
It's going to be lectures and talks and interviews like this. And the purpose of Future Primitive is to try to create a higher sense of community for the future. And I believe that the subjects we're discussing today are going to be important elements in that community, in the communities of the future.
I agree with you, John. You know, you make this point about Ralph and about how important he is. And I want to extend that a little bit, because one of the most interesting things about shamanism and indigenous cultures in general is this idea of the elder people in the tribe passing down tradition and sharing and teaching the younger. And we have a complete loss of that in our culture. We've got a disconnect between young people and older people.
Yeah, young people totally diss older people.
Yeah. And as I get older,
I experience it. I'm talking from experience, and I tell you, it's very painful.
Oh,
I'm discounted.
Well,
because I'm older.
It's weird because... In my atmosphere here, and I'm in a college town, you know, and I spend a lot of time out and about and stuff, and I have a reasonable relationship with the generation of younger people, but it takes a tremendous amount of effort, and there's always it's not at all a natural thing for them, you know what I mean?
It isn't.
It really seems like it's not, and it's unfortunate, because when you break through those barriers or whatever, and you actually can get down and start to have a conversation, which is something that I learned, because most of my close friends now are people who are older than me. I realize that this is where the information is, right? And I, in some
way want to try to continue that, to pass it on to people that are younger than I am, you know, that have an ear to listen. But you're right, it's not at all like it might have been in a primary culture where that's just the way
it works. Not at all. I'm usually concerned about this, and I do believe that in future primitive communities, or emergent communities, as I would like to call them, that this transmission from the older to the younger generations would be reinstated. But also, likewise, I would add, there's a transmission from the younger to the older generations as well.
Right.
And that is because young people come in with an endowment of knowledge of their own. They're not just recipients of the wisdom of older people, but they should be receptive to receiving the wisdom of older people, but they also have wisdom to give of their own. And that's a beautiful exchange that really has been taken out of our world, and our world is much, much the poorer for that.
Boy, I agree with you. It really saddens me to see the way that our elderly people are looked upon, and it's totally disempowering for them as well, because it's almost like when you feel that no one is interested in, you know, the information that you might have or the conversation or whatever, well, it automatically,
you shut down.
Yeah, you shut down, and it becomes,
of course,
it just becomes less important to you.
Yeah, isolation, you know, Mike, I'm glad that we're getting close to the end of our time here. I'm glad that this subject has come up. Isolation is one of the greatest threats to human survival. The isolation of the individual in technological cocooning, you know, everybody walking around with the input to their iPod stuck up their butt, you know. I mean, this is not a species that's going to survive. Isolation is an entheogenic shamanism cannot be practiced in isolation.
Right.
The thing that the psychonaut discovers must be brought back and shared with people who did not take the journey.
Yep, I think that's such a key to this thing, because this idea of isolation, that's what Western culture does. It builds walls, it creates boundaries, it creates barriers. That's the whole business of Western civilization.
Well, it goes back to the taboo. When Jehovah, who is the Gnostic demiurge, a demented god who works against humanity, this is unique to the Gnostic myth, when Jehovah prohibited our primal parents, Adam and Eve, to eat of the tree of knowledge, that was the first great feat of isolation. That meant that human society and the human species was going to enter a path where it sought its own identity and its mission purely on its own terms. It sought to understand itself in isolation from nature and the cosmos at large. And we see now where that path has taken us. There, I argue, as you know, Mike, that there can be no reconciliation between the Gaian worldview of connection and the Judeo-Christian Islamic religion, which severs us from that connection.
Wow. Well, is there a resolution? Or what is the resolution?
The resolution is that those of us who carry the vision of Gaia and the love of Gaia in our hearts have to connect and have to create our own world, and not in some way, you know, outside or beyond the culture of patriarchal ideology. That's the challenge, and it's a mighty big challenge.
Well,
I believe it is possible.
I believe it is too, and I also see that. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just lost. You know, I don't know, but I see those systems in decline.
They are in terrific decay, and you all know, we all know, that even the people who are invested in those systems don't believe in them anymore. You know, but the trouble is that decay is infectious, and that decay is not something that. Who knows? Well, maybe the decay could provide a compost, because that's the purpose of decay, right?
Right.
To provide a compost for healthy communities in the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we're still in an adversarial situation with those ideologies, because they're life-denying. You know, the most important thing to remember when you're thinking about shamanism is that it's a path of knowing through ecstasy. And ecstasy is our birthright. Ecstasy and rapture are our birthright They are what a newborn child experiences. They are what a mystic experiences. They are what an illuminated person experiences. They are what we glimpse when we stand in front of a magnificent waterfall. And that birthright, we have to reclaim it from the ideologies that have denied it to us. That is the most single most important warrior deed that we can perform today.
Wow, John, fantastic. And a fitting way to end our time, I think.
I think so. I think that's a good note to end on. Good to end up in ecstasy.
No doubt about that. All right, well, John, it has been a pleasure, a long-awaited pleasure, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And we will get this thing up on the web in 24 hours' time or so and make sure a lot of other people have the opportunity to share it as well.
Well, thank you, Mike, not only for this interview, but for all the great work you do on your radio program. And thank you for what you're going to be doing on Future Primitive. And we'll be talking a lot in the future.
Yep, I'm looking really forward to whatever that might bring, but certainly adventure. And we'll keep trying to move some of these ideas forward, John.
Okay.
All right, take care of yourself. Wonderful. I'll talk to you soon.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Sure. All right, everybody. John Lash. The wonderful John Lash. www.metahistory.org.